Since 1959, over 1 billion Barbie dolls have been sold around the world. Barbie is a cultural icon. She revolutionized the doll world when she entered the market, and she's shown remarkable longevity. Author Tarpley Hitt takes the reader on a fascinating journey through the world of Barbie and Mattel in her new book, Barbie Land, The Unauthorized Story. We're very lucky to be joined by her this morning. Good morning, Tarpley.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
So, Tarpley, what motivated you to write this book, and how long did it take to do the research?
So I started officially in February 2022, but it had been underway, you know, as a proposal long before that. And what happened was, well, I've always had an interest in dolls.
How old were you when you got your first Barbie?
You know, I didn't play with Barbies. Okay. They weren't allowed in my home. But what interests me about dolls is this, like, impulse that we've had for millennia. Any culture, any time in the world, we are making little replicas of ourselves and we're worshiping them, we're giving them to children. A lot of times it's both. You know, we're giving them to kids, but there's something sacred and emotionally invested about these objects. A couple of years ago, I wrote about the women who make reborn dolls. Have you ever heard of them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
They're hyper-realistic baby dolls, and they cost thousands of dollars because they're not uncanny. Like, they don't look kind of like babies. They look exactly like babies. Like, you pick one up and it feels like a baby. They're made from this special silicone that, like, squeezes like flesh. They're weighted to feel like babies. They're painted. You see veins. And what's weird about them is, like, they're so realistic that you have to treat them like children. Like, if you leave one in a hot car, someone will call the cops.
Mm-hmm. Oh.
If you take one outside without a sweater and it's really cold out, people are going to give you weird looks. Also, maybe someone will call the cops, you know? And what was amazing to me was how, like, the kinds of attachments people form to these baby dolls. Like, they're used in grief therapy a lot of time for when people lose children, and the people come to love them like they're real children. And then from the outside, you see that and you're like, that's kind of weird. That's not a real doll. That's not a real baby. That's a doll. And so that sort of, like, polar emotional response, I feel like you get hyper concentrated with Barbie. Like, no doll, it's the most famous doll in the history of the world. You know, no doll is more beloved and more hated. And so that sort of, like, emotional response was interesting to me. So then I hear about this movie, and, you know, I didn't play with Barbies as a kid because they were banned from my house. And I was kind of personally exhausted by a number of sequels and adaptations, and, like, there was a Cheeto movie and an Air Jordans movie and a Blackberry movie, you know, and all this stuff. And I'm like, oh God, not another one of these.
Mm-hmm.
You know? And then even a year out, people are so excited about this movie. Like, it is a genuine crazy, like, basically single-handedly revives the box office that summer. And so I'm like, what is the juice here? Like, what is the secret sauce?
So, did you get any cooperation from Mattel in writing the book?
So, the very first thing I did after selling this book was I reached out for a press pass to the National Barbie Doll Collectors Convention, which is a totally fan-run operation. And Mattel has some involvement. They come, they make giveaway dolls, etc. But, like, it's organized by grandmothers, aunts, uncles in, you know, Upper Peninsula, Michigan and Florida. Like, it is a fan-run thing. So I'm like, great, I'll work my way from the outside in and reach out to, you know, the inner circle later. Wrong. My email immediately is forwarded to Mattel. And they tell me right away, we do not participate in books. You have to license Barbie's IP if you want us to cooperate at all. And that was basically the overarching narrative of my contact with them for the next 2 years. They did not participate in any way. I talked to many people who had worked at Mattel, who currently work at Mattel, but sort of the institutional voice of the doll company did not speak.
And one of the things you mentioned in the book is how reluctant many of these people are, even after they've left Mattel, sort of guardians of the secrets of Barbie.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of the main characters in this book, a lot of them signed NDAs. You know, like, poor Carter Bryant, who we'll get to later, but is the designer of the Bratz dolls, and the main conflict of the last quarter of the book is sort of, he comes up with the idea for Bratz while he's sort of employed by Mattel, and it's sort of unclear, was he at Mattel or was he not? They sue him, and just, he loses everything. He's like at the top of the doll world for a second, and then he is a pariah. I mean, fortunately for me, maybe not for him, this lawsuit means that so much information about this case is public record, and there's transcripts, and you can find exact dialogue of who said what when. But, you know, reaching out to him, it was hard to get in touch, because he has a good reason not to want to talk about this anymore. Yep. And also he signed a settlement agreement.
We'll come back to him, as you say. It is sort of the key to the last quarter of the book. It's a lot of a really interesting story. But let's go back to the beginning. How did Elliot and Ruth Handler come to start Mattel and find their way into the toy business?
So Ruth Handler and Elliot Handler are high school sweethearts, basically. They're both from Denver. And, you know, they have this kind of will they or won't they relationship where, you know, he's sort of a starving artist type, and her family is like, you got to find someone who's going to make more money than this schmuck. And she's sort of this really driven, you know, going to make it no matter what type personality. So they have this will they or won't they thing. She breaks it off. She moves to L.A. and stays with a friend of her siblings and gets a job at Paramount. And then lo and behold, the starving artist gets into art school in Los Angeles, California. He gets into a bunch of art schools, but he chose that one specifically for Ruth. And so they get back together, and she has that kind of anxious energy. So while he's in art school making all sorts of fun plastic jewelry or whatever, she like literally takes her suitcase and like hoofs it to all these department stores around LA selling his stuff. And their first big product that they're going to do is plastic picture frames. Plastic is like hot and new at the time. And then World War II kicks off, and all plastic is reserved for, you know, the war effort. And so they basically just sort of have scraps of wood, and they start to chisel together some mini things from those scraps. So it's kind of an accident that they get into doll furniture.
Oh, so that's how it starts with furniture.
Okay.
Yeah.
Doll furniture, I love it. So what is what was Ruth Handler's version of how Barbie, what was her version of how Barbie was invented? How does she tell that story?
The story she tells is that, so right when they start their company in 1945, she's just had two kids. And so she's being a mother, stay at home, and then eventually comes back to the workplace. But her origin story is that she sees her daughter, Barbara, her son's name is Ken, she sees her daughter, Barbara, playing with paper dolls and putting on little outfits, and they're play acting adulthood. And she's like, why is the only adult toy on offer for my child two-dimensional? Why can't she have a doll that's an adult, that's not a baby doll, etc.? I want one of those. And then as she tells it, everyone is skeptical of this idea. They're never going to be able to sell a doll that has like a woman's figure, which is code for has breasts. And it's not until later that she's able to, you know, sort of through sheer force of will, prove that this concept will work and sell it. And that's her story for at least 30 years. And then it comes out that whether or not she saw her daughter play with paper dolls, although I think there's some questions about that because her daughter was 16 at the time, she definitely 100% copied Barbie, like almost to a T, from this German mascot doll called Bill Lilly.
Okay, yeah, let's talk about that. Yeah. And by this point in time, Mattel has gotten something of a foothold in the toy industry. I mean, they're not a brand new company by the time Barbie rolls along. Tell us the story, and there's a lot of detail in the book about this, about, you know, what you think actually happened with respect to the relationship between Ruth Handler and this Lily doll.
So, I mean, I think what's interesting to me about the Lily doll is that, you know, you hear about CEOs stealing ideas all the time, you know, Facebook, what have you. But with the Winklevi twins and Mark Zuckerberg, like, they had not actually launched a Facebook.
Right.
You know, they'd had this idea, sort of. And he does it better and it catches on. That was not really true with Lily. Lily was a very much established thing and very widely known. It's like Betty Boop or Mickey Mouse. Like, this is the avatar of the biggest media conglomerate in Germany. So the story with Lily is this. Axel Springer is basically Rupert Murdoch. He's starting a bunch of papers in Germany after the war, and he wants like a big, sexy, sensational tabloid a la New York Post, Daily Mail, The Sun, that kind of thing. So he starts this paper called Bild Zeitung, and he is like obsessing over it, and he's literally laying it out himself, and he notices the day that they go to print that there's an empty space, just like a square that they don't have something to fill it. So he summons his like, you know, cartoonist mensch, this guy Reinhard Bötin, and it's like, draw something, fill us in. And Bötin draws like a sort of sexy blonde, you know, character who's named Lily. And it's supposed to be this sort of one-off thing, but it becomes super popular. Like, readers write in, she gets fan mail, like Barbie would years later. And they keep it around. They give him a contract for 25 years. That's how confident they are that this is going to be, like, a big thing. And eventually she becomes merchandisable. You know, they put her on perfumes and champagne, and she gets a song. She gets a movie in 1958. And in the process, she becomes a doll. And this doll is really popular, not just with children, but men. There's like one of her most popular formats was sort of a car dongle, like that you hang over your mirror, sort of like
instead of fuzzy lace,
front nut for something. Yeah, exactly. Initially she's mostly attracting men and adult women customers because she's sort of this like, you know, sexy piece of merch. But she becomes pretty popular. She's distributed around Europe. And eventually kids, grandparents, everyone's buying these dolls. So Ruth's official story is that she goes to Switzerland on vacation and sees this doll in a shop and is like, oh my God. Sorry. Ruth's official story, which she later tells 30 years later after it's already come out, is that she stumbles upon this doll in Switzerland. And like, oh, this is the proof of concept for the idea that I had. I now have something I can show the designers, like, this is what I'm picturing. But she actually just like literally hands it to her colleague, this Raytheon missile designer, who's really hilarious character named Jack Ryan, and says, see if you can get this copied.
So we are going to come back to Jack Ryan because that was one of my favorite chapters in the book. But let's talk about how Barbie changed the model, the whole concept for dolls.
Well, it, you know, one of the enduring mysteries is sort of why Barbie catches on as well as she does in 1959, like the minute, because there's this moment where she's launching at Toy Fair and people aren't buying because another doll who was exactly like this, also an adult fashion doll, had launched at Toy Fair the year prior and hadn't done well. And so all these buyers are looking at this doll saying, first of all, her boobs are too big. And second of all, we've already done the fashion doll thing and it's not really catching. And one reason I think why Barbie sort of emerges from her sales slump after 6 months of sort of lull is they bring in this marketing director, market researcher named Ernest Dichter, who is another hilarious character. And he is, you know, self-styled Freudian, you know, protege. He had his analyst practice on Freud Street. And his pitch basically to, you know, corporate America is like, I can get into the minds of Americans and actually tell you what they want and we can brainwash them together. And he becomes sort of notorious for this. And so Ruth brings him on and he does a study on Barbie and he concludes that sort of the sexiness that they thought was such a problem was actually not a problem and that there's a material benefit to young girls learning how to be attractive and that if you can tell parents this doll will teach your kid how to groom themselves, how to dress good, well, if you will, then parents will buy it. And so they start to sort of tweak their marketing pitch in this mode. And Barbie starts picking up.
And then we come into some outfits for Barbie. And what was the handler's insight with respect to the ongoing sales of the Barbie outfits?
Yeah. So the real selling point with Barbie is that you don't get one. If you, anyone who knows a little kid and with a Barbie collection, it's a collection, not a doll. You know, there's, they have like 17 different versions and they have a bajillion outfits. And that's sort of the appeal, is like you get this one doll, but then you keep coming back. They, the nickname for her internally was, for Barbie, was Our Lady of Perpetual Income. Because you're going to build out this massive collection. And that idea comes from two places. One is Dichter sort of emphasizes this in his study. He says, you know, emphasize the clothes, because it will create this impulse to collect rather than just buy and leave. But then also there's the guy who founded Gillette Razors, who has a great name, King Camp Gillette. He sort of, there's some debate over whether he actually said this, but he's credited with saying, give him the razors, sell him the blades, which is, you know, shorthand for a business model where you sell the razor handle at a relatively lower price, but then the customer still has to buy new razors. So they keep coming back and back and back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of the model that they applied to, the handlers applied to Barbie.
So television was booming at this time. And how did the handlers use television to market the dolls and products, you know, like Hot Wheels, in a completely new way?
So in 1955, Disney is launching this show called The Mickey Mouse Club. And what they want for that show is to get a bunch of, I think it's 15 corporate sponsors who will help them air this show throughout the year. And Mattel at that point is not worth very much money. They've gotten a foothold in the toy industry for sure, but they're not like the top five, you know. They're still kind of regional and mom and poppy. And their advertising agency pitches them on sponsoring the Mickey Mouse show, which was pretty radical at the time, not just because it would cost Mattel's total net worth, which is $500,000, but also because the mentality in the toy industry was that toy sales are seasonal, which is still true. I mean, it's always true. People buy toys around the holidays more than any other time of the year. And so no one had really tried advertising, first of all, on national television on shows directed at children, and second of all, year-round. So Mattel splurges on this sponsorship, which means their ads are playing in people's homes in January, in April, in August, and on one of the most popular children's shows of the time.
So let's talk a little bit more about Jack Ryan, because you introduced the chapter on Jack Ryan by talking about a party. Who was Jack Ryan, and how important was he in the development of the Barbie product line?
Jack Ryan was immensely important in the history of Mattel and the history of Barbie. So he's one of their earlier employee hires, and he is a missile designer at Raytheon. Not an obvious hiring choice, but so he's an engineer, and they hire him to come initially work on their, you know, toy weaponry, guns and so forth. But obviously Mattel at that time is not like a mega corporation and can't match his Raytheon salary. So they bring him on with a very unusual contractual relationship where he is a contractor and he gets a percentage of the royalties for every toy he patents for Mattel, which means that he just goes ham on patenting new toys. I mean, there was some people who I spoke to from that era, there was a little bit of bitterness because some people felt like he was putting his name on patents that he didn't really, you know, design necessarily. But he becomes a millionaire on these patents, and he's patenting Barbie stuff left and right, tons of patents. And one of the ways he chooses to spend his millions of dollars is he is just a complete Lothario party boy type, and he buys this mega mansion in Bel Air. Well, he buys three lots and combines them into a mega mansion, which he turns into like an actual castle. Like, there is a moat, there's a drawbridge, there are battlements, you know, he's buying up, you know, 15th century Italian crests, and he bought a giant gold throne from the Prince of Parma. he builds this giant treehouse in his backyard where he has black tie dinners. And, you know, I mean, it's just crazy. He's having 150 parties a year. Like, that is a lot of parties.
Wow. 2 a week, 3 week, 4 week. What? 3 weeks.
Like one every other day, basically. You know, he gets a couple weekends off, maybe.
Oh, crazy, man. So the handlers get into some legal trouble. And what was the result?
So the handlers, they're growing throughout the 50s and 60s. Sales start to plateau. The way they cope with this is just by kind of making up the numbers. They are cooking the books. I mean, if you get into the book, there's way more specifics on what specifically they did. But the takeaway is that they are inflating their growth numbers to make it seem to investors like they just can't keep up with the demand. And so Ruth Handler and her, you know, colleague slash accomplice, Seymour Rosenberg, are charged with fraud. The SEC comes in. There's a special report on everything they did wrong. They're both sentenced to 48 years in prison, which is immediately suspended because no one really cared about white collar crime at the time. And they get a $57,000 fine. And Ruth Handler is pushed out of the company she founded. It's a very sad time for her because she's also going through some other stuff. She had breast cancer and got a mastectomy. And in some ways, it was kind of a perfect storm. Like, the company was hit by a series of crises as the fraud stuff is happening. They get their warehouse burns down. There's a strike, dock worker strike. And cancer all at one time. But so eventually Ruth is pushed out and moves on to her next business, which is making fake breasts.
You know, the book follows the path of Mattel through, you know, several management changes, and it goes into some great deal. It's a lot of interesting stuff. But then we get to, as you mentioned, the last quarter of the book, and I do want to touch on that. Talk about the Bratz doll controversy.
So anyone with either children or who was a child at the turn of the millennium will remember Bratz dolls, which were these sort of like hip dolls with attitude. There were four of them originally. And they came from this company called MGA. And basically when these dolls hit the scene, they become a smash success. And Mattel is freaking out because Barbie sales have sort of not only plateaued, but there's been a series of bad decisions at the corporate level and huge scams involving certain, you know, reality TV personalities. and Barbie is sort of on the wane, and people are really freaking out internally. Like, there is a memo that comes up in the lawsuit where they refer to the Bratz dolls' success as a rival-led Barbie genocide. Yeah. I mean, the five alarm fire, they were coming up with new alarms, seven alarms. So they get an anonymous letter saying, I think you should look into MGA's relationship with this guy, Carter Bryant. We have intel on something that may be of interest to you, for you. And it's not totally clear who sends this letter, but I'm pretty certain that it's this company in Hong Kong that was involved in a intellectual property lawsuit with MGA over Bratz. They'd been making knockoff Bratz dolls. And their theory, you know, was if Mattel gets the rights to these dolls, then MGA's lawsuit is moot. And that launches a two-decade, essentially, legal battle over who owns Bratz, where just a lot of stuff happens, spying, funny judges, things of that nature.
Yeah, I did not really expect to be reading about Alex Kaczynski as I was going through a book on Barbie. But, you know, that's one of the wonderful things about this book. Every few pages, you get a surprise. Before we go, Tarpley, let's just touch on this. How much of an impact did the movie have on Barbie's prominence? And what do you see as the brand's future?
So it's interesting. The movie didn't really have much of an impact on Barbie sales. You see a small spike in Barbie sales right after the movie comes out, but it sort of levels out. And in the years since, Mattel has posted losses in several quarters. So Barbie is sort of always kind of selling relatively well, and she goes through, you know, peaks and valleys of popularity. What I think the Barbie movie did was position Mattel for its next move. I mean, they've been trying to make this move since 1955, but its next move, where it's trying to become more of a Disney-like entity, an IP empire that is, you know, licensing its vast catalog for movie and TV adaptations. And Barbie was the, you know, opening shot, but they have dozens of IP adaptations in the works now, including my favorite is the one that's for supposed to come out about Viewmaster, you know, that like iBox. Like I'm sure it can be done, but I struggle to see where the narrative is coming from there.
Did Mattel have to license through GM to have Barbie drive a pink Corvette?
That is an interesting question, and I'm sure the answer is yes.
Yeah, that's what I figured. Well, I mean, we're seeing that.
They put out a, was it a Corvette? They put out a luxury Barbie pink sports car.
So Tarpley, talk to us about the reaction. There was a lot of criticism of Barbie by a number of writers, including some who'd be labeled, you know, appropriately feminist authors. What's your take on that?
So the movie really tries to position Barbie as kind of a feminist icon, right? And there's reporting that there was kind of a dilemma internally where Mattel was trying to get them to remove the word feminist from the film, and ultimately Gerwig was allowed to keep that word in. But I do think it's really hard to position Barbie as some kind of feminist icon just because Mattel has spent 70 years distancing itself from that word, and no one more vehemently than Ruth Handler herself, who consistently distanced herself from the women's liberation movement at the time and, you know, didn't like women. She spoke openly about how she preferred the company of men. She thought girl talk was stupid. She thought women were dumb. And, you know, I found a memo from her in her papers where she'd been asked to serve on this committee in the Nixon White House about women in the workplace. And they're trying to, decide what to recommend, how to recommend the private sector react to new guidelines that are coming down from the EEOC. One of which is that the private sector should treat maternity leave like any other disability. So job security, benefits, paid leave. And Ruth Handler is literally the person who crosses that out. She crosses that out, says, I think it's too onerous for businesses. So she had a chance to like put her thumb on the scale and do something that would have had a material benefit to American women. And she chooses not to take that opportunity. So I think there's a lot of conversation about Barbie, the image, and her relationship with feminism as like a symbol. But I think when you just look at the material relationship between the Barbie empire and American women or workers anywhere in the world, Mattel has almost every occasion erred on the side of exploiting female labor, you know, not providing benefits and things of that nature. So that's where I stand.
Tarpley Hitt, author of Barbie Land, The Unauthorized History. Thanks so much for spending time with us this morning.
Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back after this.